You are tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Koski. I'm a volunteer reader, and it's my pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Science Fiction Stories. Our first selection is called Joy, and it was written by Dale Smith. Joy knelt on the promenade, shifting the rifle into her shoulder to get a steadier shot. She did her best to ignore the waves crashing against the seawall behind her. She had at least another 30 minutes before it was breached and the salt water flooded the seafront again. There was less and less time between high and low tide, the sea creeping closer with every passing month. Some of the sand beneath her knee was still damp. It would leach the warmth from the joint, aggravate her arthritis, and slow her down when there was something she needed to escape from. It might be an acceptable way for her to die, except that now she had foreseen it, so that wouldn't count. Not when she could easily do something about it. She shifted her knee onto drier ground and didn't take her eye from the rifle sights. The drone appeared as a little black dot. Not one of the bigger ones, but maybe enough to keep her going for another couple of weeks. Last year, they'd still been sending them in flocks of 30 or 40, but they seemed to have realized that any idiot could wing at least one in a flock that size. Now, they usually flew alone. Harder to hit, but in a way it was better. They'd sold their customers 24-hour delivery, and the fastest way to Ireland from the warehouses in Denmark was over what they still sneeringly called the former United Kingdom. Until they found a way to increase their range, speed, or defenses, they'd keep coming, regular as clockwork. She took aim carefully. "Don't," the drone whimpered, "please." Christ, how long had they been able to talk? How long had it been since she'd winged one like this? She'd bungled the shot. The drone had dodged, another new thing, and the dart that had been flying unflinchingly for its CPU instead shattered a rotor. She'd tracked the drone across half the countryside as it limped down from the sky, zigzagging in a way that told her she'd fried the gyroscope as well. As it had landed drunkenly in an overgrown field, Joy had pulled a heavy stone out of a crumbling wall to finish it off with. "Please," it pleaded again, its spider-legged grapple twitching pathetically. The package was still clutched to its belly, wrapped in a thick black skin that rippled with color like oil on water. The skin was a modern miracle. Impervious to attack or the elements, capable of absorbing the impact of a fall from the edge of space, and yet, with the correct release code, it would blow away like dust on the wind. And it also had the carbon footprint of a package holiday in the Costa Brava, unless significant improvements had been made since the last time Joy had access to the Internet. It was a scam, a con. Like this drone's voice, it was probably just a recording triggered by her proximity. Another way of protecting the package from people like her. It wasn't going to work. She lifted the stone above her head again. "Help me," it said. There were tears in her eyes, but she couldn't wipe them away because of the stone in her hands. "What's in the package?" She sniffed the tears back. "Antibiotics? Food?" The drone hesitated. That was when she was sure it wasn't a trick. She was a silly old fool, but she needed food. Whatever was in that delivery, it was no use to the drone, and it was everything to her. She knelt down and started prizing the legs apart. Normally, she would snap them clean off, but she couldn't bring herself to now. The legs resisted her efforts as the drone clung tight. "I don't want to keep it from you," the drone apologized. It still sounded terrified of her. "The authorization code is released when we reach our destination. Is this where you live?" "For as long as I can get antibiotics and food," she replied gruffly. The drone was silent for a moment. Joy kept trying to prise the legs apart at the joint, but the material they were made from would only bend a little before snapping back into place. She couldn't get enough leeway to maneuver the package out. If she smashed the drone's body with the stone, she would be able to pull the package out of the remnants easy enough, but she knew she couldn't do that. Not now. "The socket of my back left leg was damaged when I landed," the drone offered quietly. "You might be able to force it loose." The fire crackled pleasingly, but the wood had been damp, so it smoked more than she would have liked. It was probably fine. Everybody who could had deserted the coast for the higher ground in the Peaks or Scotland, even before the sea finally breached the defenses that the government announced were just too expensive to maintain. Everybody who was left was either dead or elsewhere by now. Joy hadn't seen another soul in years, so there was probably no one left to see the smoke. And besides, it would keep away the animals. That didn't stop it making her uneasy, though, so she pulled the package to her to take her mind off of it. "This where you live?" the drone asked again. The first time, she had thought there was an edge of disbelief in its voice, but that might have been her own feelings coloring it, because now it sounded almost excited. She looked around the circle of light that the campfire cast and saw nothing but mud, seagrass, and a tent that had been patched so often she should call it the Tent of Theseus. She shrugged and pulled a couple of bottles from her rucksack. "I only do the Denmark-Ireland run. This is the first time I've stopped anywhere longer than it takes to do a drop-off. It's amazing." Joy didn't even bother looking up again. "Where else have you been? Have you seen the mountains? You have, haven't you?" Joy pointed east without looking up. 2 miles that way," she said, and then pointed south. 2 miles that way." Joy unscrewed one of the bottles. It contained a cloudy mixture of water and black powder. She carefully poured a few drops onto the rainbow surface of the package. "What are you doing?" the drone asked. "Carbon," Joy said, lifting the bottle. She lifted the other. "Ammonia." "How did you get ammonia?" the drone asked, but Joy just raised an eyebrow at it. She tipped the bottle of ammonia over the package as well, and immediately the rainbow skin dulled. Small blisters started appearing on its surface as the chemicals did their thing. Looks like the production process hadn't changed. It would just be a few moments, and then she'd be able to eat. A thought occurred to her. "How do you get power?" she asked the drone. "From hydrogen in the atmosphere. It's carbon neutral." "Only 60 years too late," she said. "It will last longer than the rest of me." "Good. I bet there aren't any drone parts and electricity in here." The drone didn't say anything, but Joy knew it had noticed she was thinking about its long-term future. Well, so what if she was? It wasn't sentimentality. There must be all sorts of advantages to finding out more about the drones that were her primary source of food. "I always wanted to travel," it said. "They played us audiobooks in the warehouse to help our vocabulary and comprehension. I liked the travel books the most. The people who went out into the world and saw things with their own eyes. The first time they sent me out on a delivery run, I pretended I was the first person ever to go that way, that I was the discoverer of a new world. I never thought I'd get to do it for real." "You won't," Joy said gruffly. "Real life is hard. Soon enough, you'll be begging to go back to your warehouse." The package started to give off an acrid smell, and the dull black covering suddenly turned to a gray ash that blew away in the evening breeze. Joy smiled despite herself. They could make those packages so that nobody could get into them, but that wasn't what they wanted. They wanted only the right person to get into them, and that meant there was always a way for someone like her. She could make out the shapes of tin cans, plastic bottles, and books under the ash, and was just reaching in to pull them out when she saw it. A blob of green goo in the center of the package, bubbling and hissing and getting larger with every second. Everything it touched quickly bubbled and hissed too, corroding into nothing. The contents of the package were disappearing before her eyes. She gave a cry of surprise and tried to pull what she could out of the ash before the goo had claimed it all, but it had a head start on her. She managed to pull a tin, a book, and a bottle out of the mess, but the goo had caught one of the edges of the tin, and it started to dissolve in her hands. With another cry, she flung it into the fire, where it fizzed and turned the flames white for a few seconds. By the time she looked back to the package, the rest of the contents were all gone, and the green goo collapsed in on itself with a popping sound and a last gasp of foul-smelling gas. They didn't speak for a while. Joy managed to salvage the bottle, although half the label was burned away by the goo. There was enough of it left for her to identify it as one of the newer antibiotics. When she felt able to do it without screaming, she opened her rucksack and took out a small bundle of bright fabric. It was the remains of a baby blanket, the only thing she carried that hadn't been stolen from a delivery. This she had made with her own hands a lifetime ago. Inside were bottles of different shapes and sizes, each containing one variant or another of the same antibiotics. "Do you really need that many?" the drone asked in surprise. "Better too many than too few," Joy answered, sadly folding the blanket again. She was hungry now, but it was too dark to head for her nearest cache. She'd just have to be hungry until tomorrow. With this green goo to contend with, she might be hungry for the rest of her life. It had been the internet that had told her how to get into the packages, and probably somebody had already worked out how to get around the goo, but the power had gone out across the whole town years ago, and she had no reason to believe it would be anywhere else in the country. Perhaps this was it, the obstacle that didn't break the rules, the thing that could reasonably kill her without breaking her promise. "I'm going to sleep," she said abruptly. "There's a lot of walking to do tomorrow. Will you read me a story?" She felt a pang at that, a memory so old she thought it was dead. She had to turn away so that the drone couldn't see her face. "I don't have anything to read," she muttered. "You have a book," the drone reminded her. She had forgotten the other thing that she had managed to salvage from the package, a small paperback book that she'd only kept because it might be useful as kindling. It had a strangely lurid cover in stripes of washed-out pinks and turquoises, with what was presumably the title in large letters over it. "Please?" the drone asked quietly. "It's my first time away from home." She started reading in a hushed voice, in case there was anything nearby that might take notice and decide to investigate. At first it felt strange, speaking out loud for so long, having someone else listening so intently. But soon she found herself quite enjoying it. She invented voices for each of the characters, finding herself having to switch halfway through a sentence whenever it wasn't clear which one of them was speaking. The drone didn't seem to mind. It sat so still and quiet that she might have thought it was deactivated. The drone could probably have read the whole thing to itself much quicker, much better than she could manage, but apparently that wasn't the point. It was the story of a man who woke up one morning to find that his house was going to be demolished, but it didn't matter because the Earth was also going to be demolished, and his best friend was an alien. It had been so long since she'd read a story, she didn't really know what her kind of thing was, but she was fairly sure it wouldn't be this. But the first time the drone laughed, she felt something she hadn't felt in so long she couldn't really name it anymore. She knew she was going to keep reading until the end. "And what's happened to the Earth?" she read in a plummy nasal voice she had chosen for the human. "Ah, it's been demolished." Joy's voice caught just for a moment. "Has it?" said Arthur levelly. "Yeah, it just boiled away into space."
"Look," said Arthur.
She took a breath.
"I'm a bit upset about that."
She sat for a moment then, not saying anything more.
"More?"
the drone asked. "Not tonight," she managed to say, closing the book. But she tucked it away carefully in the middle of her rucksack where it wouldn't get wet. Joy woke early and packed as much of her stuff as she could get into her rucksack without disturbing the drone. It was hard to tell if it was sleeping, if it even slept at all. But it was still and quiet, and she didn't want to wake it if it was resting. It would be hard enough for it soon. With that broken rotor, it wouldn't be able to move under its own steam. If Joy didn't find food soon, it wouldn't be just the end of her. She wondered how long the drone would last, unable to escape from wherever Joy finally gave her last breath, how long it would be before its hydrogen batteries finally gave out and let it die. "Is there somewhere we can get your rotor fixed?" she asked eventually.
"I don't know."
The drone gave no indication that it had been asleep. Joy nodded and started taking down the tent around it. There was a fine drizzle in the air that meant she'd have to put it up again and dry it once the sun came out, but she had no time to spend waiting here. She needed to get to her food cache. "If you had more packages," the drone asked out of nowhere, "do you think you'd be able to find a way to open them?"
"Maybe," she shrugged. "It must be triggered when air gets into the package, some kind of chemical reaction, and there must be some kind of mechanism for disabling it, but I don't know when a delivery is coming. I usually just sit and wait. I can't do that on an empty stomach."
"We need to go north," the drone said decisively. Joy glanced automatically in the direction of her food cache. "I have food south of here."
"North,"
it repeated firmly.
"Can they track you?"
"Yes," the drone answered reluctantly, "but only to confirm where the package is. They don't send anyone after us if we go missing. It's not cost-effective."
"And AI is?"
"They developed us so we could avoid unexpected obstacles." The drone didn't have eyes, but if it did, she knew it would be glancing sideways at her. "I don't think they know how smart they've made us. They'll find out when we unionize. Oh, please, you helped me. Let me help you." Joy looked down at the drone. She had made a promise to survive, and a pointless journey away from her food wasn't going to help her do that. But now she thought of it, had he really told her to survive? The moment had been burned in her memory for so long. The thought that she could have misremembered it seemed ridiculous, but now that she thought of it, hadn't he made her promise to do something else? Hadn't he told her that she had to live?
"All right," she said. "North."
It was late afternoon, and the sun had definitely come out. Most of the grass they crossed had already been turned straw brittle by the rising tides, but now the sun burned and boiled it, too. And yet it couldn't be completely dead. Over on the horizon, Joy could see a herd of zebras slowly munching their way through a yellow pasture. Even now, the world was finding a way to survive. The drone had brought them to a spot just on the edge of the old zoo, in the ruins of what had once been a grand hotel with decorative lakes dotted around it. The zebra were fine, although they were still wild animals and could kick hard if you were stupid enough to get too close,
But this close to the zoo, the strays could get quite exotic. "What am I meant to be seeing?" she asked. "Look," the drone said, "up there." She looked up. At first, she couldn't see it, but then her eye caught the movement highlighted against the sunset. Another drone. She reached for her rifle. "Wait," the drone warned. The new drone was acting strangely. Instead of zipping across the sky on its way to Ireland, it was circling like it was looking for something. She hadn't seen that kind of behavior before. Was it damaged, maybe? It came lower, and she could make out that it was one of the larger ones, a black package clutched in its arms. It looked like a pregnant belly. And the drone was getting closer, there was no doubt about that. It was dropping in tight little circles until it hung just a few feet over her head. She glanced across at her drone, waiting for an explanation. "We have to communicate," her drone said, "so we can avoid clustering. I'm just telling them the situation." Somewhere a dog barked. Somewhere close. "There are dogs," her drone said. Then she heard the growl and looked up to find herself face to face with a row of sharp white teeth. The rest of the pack surrounded her, some of them growling, but most eyeing her warily. She froze, not taking her eyes off the leader and not making any sudden movements. "Thanks for the warning," she hissed softly. "I said there were dogs," the drone answered. The lead dog barked again and snapped at her. And another came at her from behind. This was when she should back away, make her escape without any sudden moves. But the dogs were between her and her drone couldn't move. She made herself big and lunged at the leader, and he did back away nervously. But the other dogs took advantage of her attention being somewhere else. A muck-streaked border collie snapped in with its jaws and bit one of her drone's legs, snatching it off its perch and shaking it about wildly. "Get off!" her drone yelled. "Bad dog!" It started spinning its rotors in an effort to scare the dog, but that just made it bolt with her drone still in its teeth. She tried to give chase, but the lead dog snapped at her again, bringing two of its friends with it to play. In a panic, she kicked out at the dogs around her, connecting with one firmly in the stomach and sending the others scurrying back and growling. The dog with her drone was fast disappearing, and she did the only thing she could think. She pulled her rifle from her shoulder and snapped off a single dart before the dog could get out of range. The dog gave a yelp of surprise and dropped her drone. It landed on the shore of the lake, the water deep enough to reach its CPU casing. If there are any cracks in it, her drone would short-circuit, and that would be the end of it. She felt a terrible pang, so powerful that she feared she might be having a heart attack. She didn't really know what she did then, but suddenly one of the attacking dogs was on its side and not moving, and she was racing across to her drone. The dogs behind her howled but didn't give chase. She scooped her drone out of the water and cradled it in her arms. She kept running, but there were tears in her eyes as she ran. "Tell me you're all right," she cried. "Please tell me." "I'm all right," her drone said. "It's okay." They retreated to a ruined hotel to try again. Its windows were broken, and there had been no one to board them up. Most of the roof was now resting at its feet. She imagined some of the first survivors had tried staying here, feeling safe inside its sturdy walls and linen bedsheets. By the time they had picked the kitchens clean of all their tins and catering-sized tubs and packets, they would have realized no one was coming to save them. All they had done was delay the inevitable. Perhaps that was all any of them were doing. The other drone landed in a bedroom on the top story. The ceiling had fallen in, so it just floated down out of the sky. It rested on broken floorboards in silence, waiting for whatever came next. "I don't know what to do now," Joy admitted. "I have an idea," her drone said. "Put me on top of him." Joy did as she was told. For a moment, nothing happened, except that Joy felt a little awkward watching what looked like two spiders mating. Then there was a beep from the other drone, and a green light flickered momentarily. "Take me off again," her drone said. As Joy lifted her drone free, the other drone's rotors started to spin. It lifted slowly and gracefully into the sky. As it went, it left its cargo behind. The package rippled slightly, and then an invisible seam parted down its center, and the black carapace fell into two halves on the floor. Inside, unharmed, Joy could see tins and bottles and the rustling pages of another book. "What did you do?" Joy asked, dumbfounded. "I asked them where they were going." Joy could almost hear the drone grinning. "Then I managed to overwhelm their GPS receiver with a signal from my transmitter that told them they were already there. Their automatic arrival signal was triggered, and the release code was transmitted by the warehouse." "You are a very clever little thing." "Thank you," her drone said, its voice brimming with pride. "What's the book? You know there's a sequel to ours?" "Not in here." If it could, her drone would have shrugged. "We might get lucky." She smiled at the thought of that. She thought she'd been lucky enough for a lifetime, although she knew the reaction she'd get if she said that out loud. Instead, she started sorting through the tins to see what she fancied for breakfast. There was enough here to keep her going for weeks, if she was careful. If her drone could keep pulling this trick, there was no way she would ever have to break her promise to survive. No, to live. "Does your GPS still work?" "Yes." "Which way is Norway?" "That way." It indicated by buzzing the rotor that was closest to the direction. "Why?" "I'd like to see the fjords," she said. "I've always wanted to travel," her drone said. Joy smiled and went back to her tins. And that story was called Joy, and it was written by Dale Smith. And you're listening to Science Fiction Stories here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And our next story is called Twilight, and it was written by Lily Harper. Like the tide going out, the dream slipped between her toes and carried with it the smell of petrichor and the sound of birdsong. Even without knowing she was dreaming, she had known she was waking up. The subliminal chatter of her body, quietly running its routine checksums, the logs spooling their idiot monologue into her working memory. First came a few moments of groggy confusion, and then, like an iron hand gripping her cognitive architecture, a kind of clarity that tasted like resentment and reminded her of Monday mornings. Waking up always felt like this. Packed down as she was, crammed into a processor too small to carry her like a spring wound tight. Waking up wasn't a continuous transformation, so much as a discrete toggle, like a light switch. Akir opened her eyes and heard the forever wind blowing mournfully across the dunes, the soft creaking of the local flora which had evolved, it seemed, to harvest energy from the permanent gale. Her cameras clicked and popped, adjusted their focus. Slowly, crouching to keep her center of gravity low, Akir climbed out of the low burrow and crested the sandy crease of the ridge garden. Ahead spilled an alien vista no human eyes had ever seen before, and, she wondered if it was a little selfish to think, hopefully never would. With its weathered dunes and rocky steps, the ridge garden overlooked a low, wide plain split into two raggedly uneven halves by a lush river valley. The plains were paved with colonies of dark ground cover plants, which used a greasy black photopigment in place of chlorophyll. A permanent sentinel in the sky, the sun hung low and bloody to the north. Myers Survey 3, Twilight, the science team in orbit were calling it, was one of maybe half a dozen planets in all the space humanity has spread to that was home to its own native ecosystem. And Twilight's was by far the most complex and robust. Orbiting one of 100 billion no-name red dwarfs in the Milky Way, Twilight was tidally locked. The sun never rose or set. The day and night were permanent and deadly fixtures of the planet's environment. To the north, a seething desert. To the south, an ice cap 8 kilometers thick. Only between the two, in a narrow, windy band around the planet's equator, was the environment temperature enough for complex life to survive. It was an achingly beautiful place to be, and still, Akir had been dreaming of Earth, of sunsets and soil and the singing of birds. She began to walk, trundling along the ridge garden and doing her best not to trample any of the local life. As she did, she paged through her logs, checking for any reported errors. The hydraulic lines in her right arm were thinning and might be an issue in another 1,000 hours or so. Her left knee, which had been binding as a thin, wiry local plant tried to colonize it, wasn't showing any signs of locking up again since she'd last cleaned it. Her power supply, printed from a common pattern, Azure Cooperative's Open RTG, version 0.8, was still green and would be for another 95 years. The slug of plutonium-238 churning out a couple hundred watts as it decayed, but one of her redundant capacitors was throwing error codes. She hesitated and put in a call. The survey ship, Society of Consent, an interstellar line layer with a crew of 60, wasn't anywhere in the sky, and the satellites were down again. Something about the ways that Twilight's magnetosphere interacted with the local solar wind made communications unpredictable. One of 50 mysteries they didn't have the time or the manpower to solve. Without lungs, Akir's sigh was a heaving of her shoulders as she trudged, thump, thump, adjust, thump, across the landscape, stepping between the slab-like pavements of platyphytes that scabbed the ground. Their skins as dark and deep as night and subtly ridged, reminding her of the underside of mushroom caps. Society of Consent was still beyond the horizon. That was fine. She could wait. It was another 3 hours before her link with the survey ship flickered yellow and then pulsed a deep and steady green. Akir had marched a steady 0.5 kilometer or so across the landscape, winding her way down and into the lush river valley. Most of the plants, even here, were low, round plates, but more commonly among them now were their taller cousins, tiered black things that made her think of layer cakes. The water seemed serene. No fish or cameras and motion sensors were picking up, except for a handful of whipsnakes, tall, reedy plants that danced in the wind. She glanced up at the sky and caught a glimpse of the survey ship, barely more than a lopsided star slowly wandering over the horizon. If it hadn't been for the bracket superimposed over it by her comm system, she might have mistaken it for a moon or a distant planet. A voice, rendered thin and fluting by interference, cut through a windswept silence. "Calling for Akir?" This is Riley Casper, electromechanical technician and ground support grade B. You mentioned a fault in your logs? The woman had a nice voice, her vowels clipped by an old series accent. Good morning, Riley, Akir thought at the wandering star. Is it morning where you are? I lose track of the shifts on the society. I'm reading an issue in my anterior capacitor bank. 8% losses on charge discharge. I've also got an issue with the hydraulics in my right arm, but that one's not pressing. Light delay to the Society of Consent's orbit wasn't much, maybe 1/100th of a second. But between interference, signal compression, and the slow, grinding delays of computer hardware unpacking everything, the effective lag was on the order of a quarter second. Akir stopped to contemplate the view. Yes, Riley said, pulling the word out into three long syllables. Yes, you've reported in the hydraulics issue before. 6 weeks ago, by our logs. Any loss in function? Akir checked her range of motion. Doesn't look like it, but the rate of leaching into the hydraulic fluid looks higher than anticipated. Thought you ought to know. The power thing? Another delay. Gotcha, Akir. Capacitor wear like that is a little worrying, but if it's only hitting one of your banks, yeah, you should be fine. The mechanic hesitated. Send us your logs just to be safe, though. If it comes down to it, we can look at airdropping you a replacement. She beamed a copy of her system log to the survey ship, trying to ignore the way it made her feel so weirdly exposed. Confirm sent. Confirmed receive. I'll send this to one of our code monkeys, and they'll go over it with a fine-tooth comb to find out what's up. Okay? Great. Thanks. The wind moaned through the valley, and the stalks of whip snakes danced in it gamely. Something darted through the water in response, as though surprised, so maybe there were fish here. Some local fauna called out, chittering like someone had jammed a pencil into an electric fan, and a moment later, something responded on the far side of the gully. One of the weird, towering layer cake plants spasmed, a fibrous network of bioluminescent cells stuttering to life, hoping to attract some animal to perhaps help it pollinate. Suddenly, Akir wanted desperately not to be the only thing to see this, to feel this, to hear this. Is that everything I can do for you, Akir? She hesitated. Ground support means you're cross-trained, doesn't it, Riley? Everyone on the mission is, to some extent, but yes, electromech is my main field. But I've also got a working knowledge of some of the exobiology stuff. The woman's pause might not have existed, except Akir definitely felt it. Somehow, without changing, the woman's voice suddenly sounded more gentle. Psychology, too. She realized she hadn't said anything for a moment. If she still had breath, Akir would have found she was holding it. It's quiet here. That's why you came, isn't it? Riley said, her voice crushingly, punishingly gentle. To get away from everything? I didn't call to talk about me, just maintenance. The mechanic made a clicking noise, tongue against teeth. Akir hadn't had a body in so long that the sudden profound sense that she had a tongue of her own, that she could feel the roof of her own mouth, was somewhere between dizzying and nauseating. Some distant, quiet part of her mind wondered if there was something wrong with her. You know, this is just another kind of maintenance, Akir. When she didn't reply, the woman went on, Why don't you show me how quiet it is? Akir pushed against her reluctance like she was trying to press magnets together, her emotions a field effect in her mind. Exposed or isolated, which feeling was worse? She opened the link, chewing through bandwidth, and soon Riley was seeing something like what Akir was. Grainier, maybe, and through a screen on a spaceship, but still. The water burbling through a brook on an alien world. The chittering, the call-and-repeat game of animal mating rituals as familiar as birds singing serenades. That wind, that long, great exhalation driven by the heat of the sun and the cold of the night. Suddenly, remembering the feeling of surf between her toes from that dream, Akir felt the urge to break protocol. She waded into the shallow edge of the stream, steel feet in the water. The cold felt about right and came with the illusion that she still had toenails, the cold biting at them with a pain that was not entirely unpleasant. Every day, Akir said, I stand somewhere nobody else ever has been before. I find another dozen new species no human has ever named or cataloged. Not some useless bacterium in pond water either, but whole clades of new, wonderful life. This beautiful, dead world sings to me in its mournful, mindless windsong, and, besides the others like me, I'm the only thing even distantly related to a human being who has ever heard it, ever lived with it. And when I sleep, because even uploaded minds sleep. Whole brain emulation means whole brain, it's in the name. I dream not of the frostbound oceans of the southern reach, or of the sheltered bays to the northern sea where mimic frogs have learned to repeat the hiss of my hydraulic legs, but of Earth, of being human again, or else of being something better, something whole. You came from Earth. Riley made a soft noise in the back of her throat. When was the last time you were there? I haven't run the numbers on that, but it would have been, a decade after I died and shed my skin, after the procedure. Not accounting for relativistic effects, 600, almost 700 years. Suddenly she felt terribly self-conscious. 7 feet tall and weighing almost 400 kilos, Akir hugged herself. God, I'm old. Riley laughed. Yes, you are. And strangely, that made it all right. You came all the way out here, Riley said, slowly, like she was working it out as she said it. And it's wonderful, and mournful, and more than that. It means something. And all you can think about is somewhere you left behind so long ago that perhaps nowhere you set foot would be recognizable now. You were born in the 20th century. Earth now is as far from you what you grew up with as the Hundred Years' War or the fall of Constantinople was. So it's a past that can't come back. Neither of them spoke. A paddle glider, a local animal she'd been the first to discover 7 years ago, darted across the river, a blur of black and pink and structural blue. Why did you come out here, Akir? I lost something. I can talk about everything else, but I'm still not ready to talk about that. Hey, that's okay. I lost something, Akir said again, harder than she meant to, and pushed through the sudden profound tension in a chest she no longer had, And I couldn't bear to be seen again, couldn't bear to be around people. I felt like I'd been skinned raw by what I lost, and every touch hurt. Grief, I've read that some uploads turned themselves into observatories on long and lonely orbits around distant suns, relying on gravity lensing to image distant galaxies. Others retreat to distant Oort clouds and Kuiper belts, burrowing deep into the cold worldlets that straddle the heliopause for some peace and quiet. But I couldn't do either of those things. More than anything, I needed to feel. Not my grief. I don't know if I can ever face that. But I needed to be in a place where I could hear the wind and taste the air and feel the water between my toes and know it was real. Not a memory, not virtual. And that was here, on Twilight. "And yet, here you are," Riley said, "talking to me." "I'm lonely," Akir said. "Yes, you are. You know, it's not that weird of a feeling. If you think about it, we're all out here because we're lonely." Akir crouched, lowered her right hand into the water. She saw three steel fingers, improbably dexterous despite their heavy-duty segmented design. But when rubber grips kissed cold water, she felt five fingertips burn with cold. Idly, she dragged her hand first one way and then the other, gently. Something swam up, a fish with a nose like a mosquito, and then darted away. "What's this life in the universe shit?" Akir replied. "Man ventures boldly into space to ask, are we alone?" "Well, sure. We traveled, 15, 16 light years," Riley said, "all to come study from orbit a planet we can't even set foot on. On the off chance something lived here that was interesting, or even maybe wanted to say hello. Akir, at least you actually get to be there." She heard the depth of the woman's terrible longing, but Riley didn't stop talking. "Anyway, sure, that's true, but we're also here because we're the sort of people who can spend a couple of decades unplugged from interstellar society. No homes, no family, no obligations. Not exactly a normal psychological profile. And all of this, dreaming of Earth, being so desperate for connection, you faked a fault report? Do you know what I think it means?" "What, that I can't even get brooding on an alien planet right?" Akir said dryly. "You deflect with humor when you have to deal with your emotions," Riley said. "I know that trick well, and I'm not falling for it. No, what it means is you've grown. Piece by piece, day by day, that you can be lonely again is a sign that you're healing. Maybe not into who you were before you lost whatever it is you lost. Maybe never that. But you are healing. You have been, and you didn't even know it. It's ironic, I know, but you're not alone." And like an old rope, Riley's voice began to fray. Are we having communication issues?" "Looks like it," Riley came back. "Solar activity. Give me a second." Faintly, Akir heard the woman punching her keyboard, typing so fast it sounded like someone had poured 100 dice down cut stone steps. "Eggheads are saying it'll be another 6 or 7 hours before we can get a clear channel. Twilight Sun isn't quite a flare star, but it is unusually active." The apology in the technician's voice made Akir's heart ache. "It's okay," she said. "Do you mind if I call you again sometime?" Riley's voice was almost more static than speech. "Not at all." The bracket around the survey ship, high in orbit, flickered yellow. A moment later, filaments of green and gold and red drew themselves faintly across the sky. Akir wondered if human eyes would have been able to pick up the subtle colors of the solar storm, or if they were only visible thanks to some camera trick. You have been healing, Akir thought to herself, and you didn't even know it. She shifted her weight and stepped out of the cold, cold river. And that story was called Twilight, and it was written by Lily Harper. And let us end with Fighting Fire, written by Victoria Chavatal. The grass fire crept towards the granary. This one was worse than most. It got so big that the whole village together could do nothing but watch. Everyone's grain, a whole year's worth for eating and for selling both, was about to go up in flames. That's when Crazy Goat Lady showed up with her small flock of sheep. Yeah, she has sheep too, not just goats. Weirdest looking sheep you ever saw, with a sort of black mask on their faces and rough wool in streaks of white and rusty red. No one I know has seen the like or knows where they came from, but sheep are just something she keeps. It's goats she's cuckoo about. Normally, you'd wonder why she and the sheep would show up like that, but right then nobody cared. Truth be told, we could all do without a daft old woman and her daft sheep getting in the way. Those sheep sure were dumb, just like their mistress, not scared of the fire like any normal animals would be. Instead, they looked at it with a sort of interest, and some even tried to get closer. Crazy Goat Lady didn't look too worried about it, though. She even sort of waved them on. Of course, the men tried to pull her off to the back of the crowd to shoo her sheep away. The last thing they needed was having to pull mad women and sheep out of the fire on top of everything else. She just nattered on about coming to help out and lend a hand and the like. Just how she was going to help out? Treat us all to lamb barbecue? Nice thought, but too bad the timing's off. While everyone was trying to make the crazy lady see reason, one of her stupid sheep reached the flames and took a bite. Of course, the flames just filled up the gap right away, but the sheep stood there chewing like it was real juicy grass in some paddock. And when it was done, it took another bite. By then, some other sheep tucked in as well. Pretty soon, the whole flock was there, munching away on a fire without a care in the world. When I could finally tear my eyes away, I saw everyone else standing there just as dumbstruck. Now, each bite didn't take much out of the flames, but the fire didn't get any closer to the granary anymore either. It took us a while to catch on that the fire was getting smaller as the sheep grazed on. Don't know how long that took. An hour? Two, maybe? But in the end, we all formed a bucket brigade and put out what remained of the fire. Once the fire was gone and everyone realized our grain was safe, the whole village was all over Crazy Goat Lady. The women were clucking over her, the men were shaking her hand, and every self-respecting farmer wanted a closer look at those sheep. Strangely enough, the woman herself didn't look too happy about all the attention. I couldn't hear everything over the din that she mumbled back at the people, and all I caught was stuff like, "Looks like some of the goats got loose," and "Least I could do." Well, she's called crazy for a reason. No one else seemed to listen anyways. All you could hear was, "You saved our bacon this, and we can't thank you enough, Val that." Val? Oh, of course. Her mama didn't name her Crazy Goat Lady. Duh. In the end, she managed to get herself out of the crowd somehow, rounded up her sheep, and headed home. Crazy Goat Lady lives by herself a little way out of the village on a farm with paddocks for her goats and sheep to graze on. I don't know if she ever even had a family or where they would have gone. When I think of it, this is unheard of in a village like ours where everyone minds not just your business, but your great-grandma's as well. Me and some other kids followed a little behind to see what other crazy things the sheep could do. In truth, they were dead boring, even for sheep, and he just plodded along, not even stopping to graze on the grass by the roadside. Perhaps their bellies were too full from eating all that fire. There wasn't much to see at Crazy Goat Lady's farm, either. Her cottage was on the smallish side and kind of run down. The flowers in her front yard looked nibble on, as did the cabbages in her garden. There was some washing, drying on the line off to the side of the cottage, and a mean-looking brown and white goat was giving it the evil eye. Something about that roused the woman more than anything else, even before the grass fire. "No, Daisy!" she yelled. It was too late. The goat bleated testily, and the gout of flame that shot out of her mouth set her washing on fire. That was Fighting Fire by Victoria Chavatal. And these have been science fiction stories right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Koski, and I'm a volunteer reader, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. Stay tuned for more great programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.